Hi, everyone. This is Tom Salami of Device Talks. Welcome back to the Neuro Innovation Talks podcast. I'm here with our guest, John Murray of J&J MedTech Neurovascular. John, great to speak with you again.
Hi, Tom. Good to see you.
Good to see you as well. This podcast series is an important one, one that we were really glad to collaborate on you with for the reasons. One of the reasons that we're here today is to share the insights of many of industry's great pioneers, including today's guest, Dr. Nick Hopkins, the late Nick Hopkins. And John, this is I've never had this experience. You knew Dr. Hopkins, and you talked to him a few months before his passing last fall. What is this experience like for you? I can't say I've done more podcasts than I can remember, but this is an experience, fortunately, I haven't had.
Yeah, it is a difficult situation, but I think that we're very fortunate that we had the opportunity to connect with Dr. Hopkins. You know, as much as I would say he's a pioneer, he's revered in our field as one of the most significant thought leaders, especially in the neurosurgery community. But for me, he was a friend, someone that I learned a lot from. And of course, I would say I was honored to know him. And I'm sure that I speak for hundreds or thousands of people that would feel the same way. And while I was working with the team on the podcast series and identifying those pioneers, certainly Nick Hopkins was very much on the top of that list. And those that I talked to before and after his passing were thrilled to death that I was going to connect with him. But now that he's passed, grateful that we were able to capture some of his insights. So it is quite a different situation, but I'm really pleased that we caught him in a moment where he was strong and energetic and enthusiastic. And I think you'll see that in the podcast.
And I think these stories just really demonstrate, like I said, I never had the chance to talk to him, and I wish I had, but I knew him. And it's amazing the impact that people have in this world without physically or verbally touching anyone. For to have someone like me who's, again, never talked to him, when I heard of his passing, I was really saddened. Yeah. So I can't imagine how those of you who had the direct contact with someone who has this influence and this power, how that really impacted you in the industry. What do you feel like the broader response of the industry has been? I'm sure there was a great deal of sadness in the fall.
Yeah, there was a lot of sadness. And I think today a lot of people are reflecting on all of the things that he did for them and how he motivated them and how he forged a path for them. You know, we spoke to physicians that from multiple disciplines, and all are very consistent that he embodied thinking differently. He was the one that said, we could do it differently. We don't have to follow the same path that others have. So I think most people are recognizing that. And while they're sad to see him move on, I think today they realize, wow, I'm reflecting on all the great things that he did do. So in a way, right, when somebody passes on, it gives us an opportunity to reflect on all the great things that they did and remember that. And this is certainly the case with all of the physicians that he mentored and the physicians that those physicians mentored and the impact that he's had across the globe for patients and for innovation.
That's great. And of course, you've communicated with the family, and they were also very gracious in letting us go forward and sharing this conversation. So we're grateful to them. But I love the notion of thinking differently. It's amazing. So many of us go through our days doing what's expected and anticipated and maybe believing something could be done differently, but we don't actually pursue it. So I think it's a real superpower of folks like Dr. Hopkins who take that inspiration and turn it into reality. And it's really wonderful to be able to share that sort of story. And I'm sure for you, you're in contact with those people a great deal during your day. It must be uplifting.
I think we're going to find a lot of listeners to this podcast just to remember some of the great things that Nick had to talk about. But I also want to highlight one important element as well about Dr. Hopkins. He was also an amazing community leader. He was very much instrumental in the Buffalo area in helping that Buffalo area strengthen and grow. So he took care of patients, he trained physicians, but he was also a dedicated community leader, as much as he was a physician. So for me, I feel like he was a well-rounded individual that cared about others.
And before we pushed record, you were talking about your New York Jets. Was he did you and he have a good rivalry going with the Bills? Is he a football
He was definitely a Buffalo Bills fan and
guy?
also liked baseball. He used to go to a lot of the
Fantastic.
minor league games up in Buffalo. But
Yeah,
yeah, I miss him.
I bet you do. Well, I'm glad that we're able to give folks a glimpse into his work, into who he was, into how he thought. And John, I'm grateful to you for helping us put this series together and telling stories like these. Thank you.
Pleasure. Honored.
Before we begin this episode, I'd like to bring in a conversation our managing editor, Kayleen Brown, had with our sponsor, Zeus.
Darren Amick, strategic account manager for Zeus, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to be here.
Well, I'm very much looking forward to learning more about Zeus. So for our audience, Darren, would you please give us the 30,000 foot level? Tell us about Zeus.
Okay, Zeus is a world leader in custom polymer solutions and innovations, and we have been for nearly 60 years now. Our mission is to provide solutions that enable innovation and enhance lives. We partner with all of the blue chip medical device OEMs, focusing on therapies across neurovascular, structural heart, electrophysiology, peripheral vascular, among several others. And our goal is to be an extension of our customers' R&D departments, as well as have the scale and capacity to be able to meet their needs and grow with them over the next 5, 10, 15 years.
You know, that has me thinking. I know that you have a rich background in med tech. So how did you find your way to Zeus?
So I came over here because of what, number one, Zeus can do in the market, and number two, what CathX brings. And I've known Suresh for quite a while, and having him as our CTO, having contract manufacturing with a team of experts that have been in the industry for 20 years that I think are some of the best in their cross functions at what they do, we're in a unique position to be able to do really innovative, complex catheter components and subassemblies. And where, you know, I want people to know our engineering expertise and the combination of catheter development and the engineering expertise on the Zeus side allows us to offer something that no one else can.
That was just a taste of our sponsor interview with Zeus. We'll hear more from Darren Amick a little later on in the podcast, so stay tuned. For now, if you want to learn more about Zeus, please visit their website, zeusinc.com. And now we're back to our memorial episode honoring Dr. Nick Hopkins.
Dr. Hopkins, I just first want to open up with a big thank you to you. And it's a personal thank you because way back in the mid-1990s, you were very gracious and opened up your lab to me to visit, observe, and learn. And you took the time to expose me to the neurovascular field in a way that I would say has engaged me to the point where I could never leave the space. And it was because you were open to the collaboration between industry and clinicians, and you fostered that relationships over the 25 plus years that I've known you. And I very much appreciate and value all of that experience that I've been able to participate in. Now, I'd like to dive into a couple of questions for you. You've been quoted as saying, "I've never been a guy who was comfortable doing everything by the book. I've always looked around to ask, is there a better way than what's in the book?" Now, it takes a creative entrepreneurial mindset to rewrite the book, sometimes even in a moment. Can you elaborate on your philosophy here and talk about how this informed your work?
Sure. I think if you're going to rewrite a book, I think if you set out to rewrite the book, ain't going to happen. But if something stimulates you to start thinking about something in a different way, That to me is the way you get started. And then you kind of supplement that with a natural curiosity. And that I think is very important. You know, you just got to be a curious person. And if you decide you're going to do something, then I think you got to decide you're going to make a commitment. And in the line of work that we're in, you can't be committed every minute, but every waking minute that you're thinking about it and not doing something else is important. So then the other thing I think is perseverance, because you're going to take a lot of grief. There's no question when you do something new, you're going to get a lot of grief. And in our specialty, you know as well as I do that the grief is coming from multiple specialties. So that makes it even more interesting. The other thing I think you need to have is a really thick skin. And because mm-hmm. when people, you know, shoot arrows at you, you got to just be willing to let it bounce off.
I hear you. And as one of the pioneers in our field, and I might even call you a maverick, what was it that drove you personally to commit all of that energy that you have and the resources within Nick Hopkins to addressing the unmet needs? There were lots of challenges and obstacles. What was that driving force for you?
So the stimulus for me basically was pretty simple. As a first year resident in neurosurgery, I didn't know anything. I didn't know one end of a catheter from the other. And I was scrubbed on a patient with a ruptured aneurysm. Good surgeon, but an ACOM aneurysm, you know, in those days with no microscope, no tools. I mean, we had tools that were, you know, good for gallbladders, not for aneurysms. And the poor guy struggled. And I was just an assistant as a first year resident, and the aneurysm ruptured, and he had no ability to control it down in the base of the brain. Long and the short of the patient bled out and died. That was an epiphany for me. Like, you know, there's just got to be a better way to do this than what he was doing. And the technologies involved with open surgery to the point where we're very good at treating aneurysms surgically. But back then, we didn't have that. And so I got to thinking about the vascular highway. And if you can enter the vascular highway almost any place, then you can reach the brain pretty short order. And so, and I had I was at the county hospital. I had a senior resident who was pretty busy and very accommodating. And I started monkeying around with catheters. Back in those days, there weren't any rules about what you could do and who you could operate on and how you operated on them. And so I actually started putting catheters in patients. Probably shouldn't have been doing that, but I did. And to see how easy it was to get to the brain, and that was the stimulus that got me going. And then I had a very interesting and challenging case when I first got into practice that really convinced me. And that was a patient with a carotid cavernous fistula, which is a hole in the carotid artery due to an accident. The artery is torn, and the artery is in the sinus, so it's bleeding into the veins. And so the eye is bulging out, and patients lose vision, et cetera, et cetera. And back then, the ways we treated carotid cavernous fistula were so crude that I won't even describe them. But I knew of a balloon that somebody had developed in the Boston area that was really, really a urology balloon. But it was triple lumen. And I got my hands on a couple of these balloons, and I cut down on the patient's carotid artery and put this catheter in there and slid it up, and it went up very easily into the cavernous sinus. And I blew up the balloon, and the bleeding stopped. And I could tell by injecting the other two lumen of the balloon that that I, you know, I had stopped all the flow to the brain, but the brain wasn't getting anything anyway. And patient was doing fine. And so that was my first real clinical triumph. And I look at that as the thing that gave me the impetus to say, okay, let's go for it. And you know, we'll see what gets in the way and we'll try to just keep going.
It certainly is thinking outside of the box there for sure. In those early days, when you were doing those types of procedures and adapting technology, when you were facing challenges, who did you call? Who did you reach out to? Who were the people that you leaned on?
There was nobody.
There was no one. Okay.
Well, this was back in, you know, early 70s. And there were a couple of other guys who were beginning to put catheters in people's heads. And I went and visited them. But, you know, when I had a problem at home, there was nobody. There's nobody I could really call. And the people that I went to visit turned out to be great friends, and I could go visit them and learn from them. One was Chuck Kerber, and the other was Grant Yashima. And both just outstanding guys. They both happened to be radiologists, but they were both very tolerant of this sort of bumbling neurosurgeon who wanted to learn. And they were ahead of me in terms of the amount of work that they were doing, but there was nobody else that I could go to at that point in time.
Yeah. And when you were dealing with those procedures, and I know there were suboptimal outcomes at times, how did you fight through that, knowing that there were difficult outcomes? How did you keep the faith and keep positive?
Again, you got to have a thick skin. And I think maybe the most important thing is you've got to learn from your mistakes. You know, a lot of people in medicine make a mistake and then they kind of dodge it or blame it on something else or. But if you really fully embrace a mistake, you know, what is the James Joyce thing? Mistakes are the portals of discovery. So if you really embrace them, and that was the beginning of a concept that we later developed into a conference, which now is called 3C in the neuro world. And we've actually expanded it to a much smaller group of thought leaders in all the other disciplines. And the rule of the meeting is you get up in front of the whole group and present your worst disaster of the year. And I think that approach was absolutely fascinating when you saw the results, especially when we got into working with other disciplines. And I remember early on, I presented a case of a ruptured aneurysm vasospasm. And back in those days, there was a little balloon, a neuro balloon, but the only thing that we had was a 3.5 millimeter balloon. And so I severe vasospasm, wasn't responding to medication. I took a balloon and put it in the middle cerebral artery and tried to blow it up gently, and I ruptured the artery and killed the patient. And one of the cardiologists in the group said to me, you know, you should see the stuff we have. And they showed me some cardiology balloons that are 1.5 and 2 millimeters. That's more like it for the middle cerebral artery. And I started way back then using coronary technology for neurointervention. And people would come looking for me, John, and the nurses would say, oh, he's not here. He's up in the cardiac cath lab.
Yeah, and that leads me to another question. And you are certainly known for someone that has encouraged this multidisciplinary collaboration. Certainly you highlighted it earlier when we talked about your first experiences. Can you talk about your desire to go outside of the bounds of what was conventional interventional neuroradiology at the time? I'm sensing that the inspiration in part was due to the lack of tools and technology and your own learning. But is there anything that you want to add or expand on as to why you felt that multidisciplinary approach was appropriate, including neurology, of course?
Like everything else, it takes a stimulus. And well, there was no interventional neurosurgery back, or neurology or anything back then. It was just a couple of people like me, renegades, screwing around with catheters. So I, when I did my training, all of our angiography was done by putting a needle in the carotid artery. And I started doing that at surgery. If I was operating on somebody and I'd put a catheter in the carotid artery. And then when I, by the time I got into practice, which was 74-5, people were starting to put catheters in elsewhere. There was no intervention by anybody, coronary or other, but I was looking for some advice on, you know, okay, how am I going to get catheters into the head? And I had a really good friend who was a cardiologist, and he had trained at the Cleveland Clinic with Mason Soans, and he learned angiography by cutting down on the brachial artery and then putting a catheter in and doing a coronary angiogram. So he taught me how to do that. I cut down on the brachial artery, put a catheter in. Instead of going down to the heart, I went up into the head. And I did that for 25 or 30 cases and realized it's doable, but it'd be much easier to go through the femoral artery. And eventually I didn't have anybody to teach me that. I started doing that. Just put a catheter in the femoral artery, take it up to the head, and do your thing. That's how I learned.
And you learned, and then you incorporated neurology, radiology into the fellows that you trained. Did you have a philosophy on who was selected, what the specialty was? What was your view on that as you started to really do the fellowship training?
Total serendipity. I'm doing my thing, and this is going to be late 70s, early 80s. I was approached by a guy who said, I'd like to come and spend some time with you. He was actually a neurologist. And I said, sure, why not? And that guy turned out to be a cardiologist and a very good one. And so he came and scrubbed in with me. And I kind of taught him how I was doing cerebral angiography. And then out of the blue, somebody else approached me. This guy was a neurosurgeon from St. Louis. Said, I'd like to learn how to do what you do. And I said, well, come on, you know, hang out with me. And he came and spent better part of a year. And then somebody else called, and somebody else called. And so it gradually grew. And most of these guys were neurosurgeons, but, you know, I had a cardiologist and a radiologist and a bunch of neurosurgeons, just more neurosurgeons because I was a neurosurgeon. And when I published, I usually published in the neurosurgery literature. And I think that's how people found out who I was. You know, I'd seen an article about some crazy thing that I did, and they come visit, and that grew and grew into what has been maybe the most rewarding part of my whole career has been fellows who have come from all over the place to come and spend a year or two working with us to learn the skill. And then the really exciting part about that is many of these young guys are now out in other major centers leading the field in vascular neurosurgery, because most of the neurosurgeons are in a unique situation because you know, we always welcome all the other specialties at this point in time, all the other neurospecialties. But the neurosurgeons have a skill that nobody else has, and that is the ability to open the head if they have to, right on the spot if they need to. And although we virtually never need that now, back then, you know, sometimes you needed that. And if you were a radiologist and weren't really connected with neurosurgery, it would be a potential disaster. So I was, from the beginning, a fierce advocate for neurosurgery. I didn't care if anybody else wanted to do it, but I thought if other people wanted to do it, other specialties, they would be smart to link up with a neurosurgeon.
Great. So great a lead into what I think is something that you're certainly well known for, is mentorship. And clearly one of the impacts that you've had on the field of neurovascular surgery is the fellows that you've trained, and you just highlighted it, the impact that those individuals have had on the space themselves as leaders, developing training programs of their own, and certainly leaders in their own right. Can you talk a little bit about mentorship and your approach to it?
Mentorship is really an interesting topic. I never thought of myself as a mentor. I just thought, you know, if somebody wants to hang out with me and see what I do, what is mentorship? And I think it starts with observation, and then it leads to practice. And one of the things I think is critically important is, if you're going to be a mentor, you got to be willing to stand aside and have your mentee begin to do the work, and you coach. And a lot of people don't do that. So people go get trained someplace and they come out and they really don't know what the heck they're doing. And so I've always been a great advocate for the fellows doing the work with us right behind them. So that's made all the difference. Then you need to be willing to accept your mistakes and study them. You need to be willing to publish. And if you publish, pretty soon the fellows want to do it for you. And they do most of the writing. But the point is, you know, you mentor them in the writing part, and that really solidifies the learning. So it's a bunch of things together that I think make a decent mentor. And you gotta be just a good person. You can't be an egomaniac.
And people will follow you as such. You know, continuing with that theme, one of your mentees, who we both know very well, said that he and his wife look to your marriage with Bonnie as a model of inspiration for him and his wife. It's very clear to me that the impact you've had on your mentees and their personal lives goes well beyond that relationship, of course, beyond medicine. How does it make you feel to hear that your mentees think of you and Bonnie in this regard?
Never thought about it, John. It just, you know, you lead your life and you do the things you do, and you try to, I guess, always try to do the right thing. And the other part is, you know, you try not to, don't let anybody scare you away from doing what you think is the right thing. But no question, the most important person in my life is Bonnie. And talk about mentorship, she's a mentor to me in a lot of ways. I find the more I listen to her, the smarter I get.
I can certainly appreciate that.
Hey folks, Tom Salami here. We're going to take a break from the conversation with Dr. Nick Hopkins. John Murray of J&J MedTech Neurovascular took the time to speak with many of his colleagues and peers and mentees. So we're going to hear from a few of them, then go back to the interview and then we'll hear from a few more. So first up is an interview that John did with Dr. AJ Waklu.
I think I have a story that summarizes a little bit how I saw Nick. And that is, we had a patient back in Buffalo who was, I think he was admitted to the ER with a subarachnoid hemorrhage. And he barely made it into the CT scanner because he was like 500 plus pounds. And as some of you know, that an angiography table has some limitations on weight. So what Nick said is, I will make this work. I think this patient needs an angiography because he may have a brain aneurysm. So he called the lab. At that time, I was working on a research project, as well as spending some time in the cath lab with Nick. So we listened to his story, and he said, can you help me out? And I said, well, you know, we do angiographies here and research in pigs that are 500-600 pounds. He said, how do you do that? He said, well, we have a crate and we can move in a C-arm. So he brought in the crate, the special crate for the pig, to the hospital. And we had a C-arm from Toshiba. And we fixed this patient's basilar top aneurysm. What it tells you, I mean, this is more a professional encounter, but what it tells you about Nick is that he's very innovative. He's very direct. He would do anything to make things happen. That's how he was, and that's how I remember him today. So there was never, if you say, okay, let's play today squash or racquetball. He was very good in squash. He would warm up against me and Lee Gutterman, and then he would play against people who play in the Olympics, so world championship. So there was never a limit to anything. There was never a thing that, you know, he couldn't address. So he grew up in a world since he was young, and I met his father and his mother and his siblings. He grew up in a world where everything was possible. It was just you who had to embrace that. You have to make the step. So there was never a ceiling. And I thought this patient who he treated then successfully is a nice illustration of that.
Are there some things that you learned from Dr. Hopkins in particular?
Having worked with at least 7 or 8 brilliant chairmen, I think that he was one of the best I worked with for many reasons. He was uncomplicated in the sense that, you know, some people who are in the academic world have a certain idiosyncrasies, and especially in Germany, where I spent my, first 30 years of my life since my childhood, there is a hierarchic model. There's the professor and then the next in line, on and on. So you had to make appointments to meet the professor and chair 2 weeks in advance. Nick was never like that. You could knock at his door and he would let you in, or he was in the middle of a phone call. He would say, give me 30 seconds. I will be right back to you. So he was a man who was approachable and very direct in handling things. So fairly uncomplicated. And that gave you a very strong sense that you are being listened, that he takes your advice or your input or your questions seriously. And I think that quick turnaround time and that personal touch that Nick had made him very successful and also likable as a human being, as a chair as well. I remember the mornings he came to the grand rounds and the M&M conference. He would always grab this huge bag of bagels. That was first time I tasted bagels. I came from Germany, so it was amazing. And the cream cheese and the coffee. So he spoiled his team. And he was a very warm-hearted guy, yeah. He came to my wedding also, and it was a spontaneous decision. So suddenly there were 3 couples from Buffalo, including him, coming to my wedding in Mexico City. So he was like that, you know, very direct, very funny, good sense of humor. I loved that about him. 3 words I would describe Nick Hopkins are maverick, great leader, great visionary.
Are there any quotes that you remember from Nick Hopkins that you'd want to share?
There's nothing you can do. He used to say that all the time. There's nothing you can do.
And if I were to ask you to zoom out a little bit, what impact do you think Dr. Hopkins had on our field? And what is his legacy?
So I'm a neurointervention radiologist. So I'm not a neurosurgeon because, of course, you will hear from neurosurgeons that he brought the endovascular field into neurosurgery and to the level where we are now operating, which is all true. For me, I think it was, as a neurointerventionist, very interesting to see that if a neurosurgeon embraces this technology that, you know, predominantly was developed by neurointerventionalists, whether it's in Europe or outside in Japan or other parts of the country in the United States, what I felt is that what Nick enabled is because he could also bail out himself out of the intervention procedures or minimally invasive procedures, that there was a more kind of area that he could explore and advance the field. So he had, he was not shying away from doing very complex things because he knew. Next thing is he could open up the head in the angio suite and fix the problem. And I think that dimension was very critical for the advancement of her field. And I adored that. I often wish that I would have gone into neurosurgery and learned that skill set. And I think it's very useful. And he did it. He did it. And also the vision that this is a multidisciplinary approach. He included physicists, imagers, radiologists, neurologists, neurosurgeons, cardiologists. And he was very skillful in bringing all these people to the same table and talk to each other. I think that's a unique skill. Not everybody can do that. He was a great politician, very respected in the hospital, of course, and had always this beautiful smile. Like, you know, it was very embracing smile, and I loved him for that.
I feel like you've caught it all, quite honestly. I mean, listening to you, you kind of refreshed in my mind his smile.
He had a beautiful smile. You remember he used to smile?
He sure did. He was so good at, like, just making you feel like you were the center of attention when you were talking to him, you know?
And the nice thing is, John, he always told you what you wanted to hear. So you felt in the conversation very important and heard. And that's something which was, for me, unique because, you know, being brought up in a very academic, strict environment, it was always that you got pushed back. And he was just the other way around. He was inclusive and he listened to you carefully. And he found always the talent in the other person. He knew, is this a person to be a chairman? Is this a good researcher? Is this a guy who would do big clinical data science? So he knew very well how to see into your soul and basically provide all the infrastructure to get the best out of you. And he was very good at that. Very, very good at that. And no, I think that's the role of a leader. Yeah. He was a leader who walked behind you, not in front of you. And there are not many people like that.
I would say that it was that's a really good description of who he was, because he could have taken more credit. He always was putting his people out there to get in front of the podium, on the podium, running different meetings. And so I think he achieved success early in life, and therefore he didn't have as much to prove anymore either.
Next, John had a conversation with Dr. Chuck Kerber. If you want to hear more from Dr. Kerber, you can listen to episode 4 of the Neuro Innovation Talks podcast.
Nick and I have an interesting history. He's a wonderful, wonderful guy. And he gets the credit for organizing us and inviting industry, which was a major step in our complications conference. But I first met him as I was a visiting professor
And I was invited up to Buffalo, and two guys came to the airport and grabbed me on the lapel and dragged me into the car. We sped to the operating room. They put gloves and gown on me. And there was this difficult patient from some South American country, some wealthy guy. And I helped Rafael. Rafael was the fellow at the time.
Rafael Rodriguez.
Rafael Rodriguez Mercado. Mm-hmm. And so we've got that finished. And then I had a chance to sit down and have a glass of water after that. I one year I took my airplane up there, and I asked Nick, I said, you want to go fly the jet? So I gave him all the full brief, an hour brief, and told him what to expect and things like that. So we took off from Jackson Airport. And if you're not in a jet with a canopy where you can see all around, there's nothing like it. It's amazing. So we take off, and he's more and more, he's flying the airplane. So I got him lined up with the Grand Teton, the biggest mountain. And I said, all right, now lift the nose up. And he lifts the nose up. And I said, put it back in the middle. And now push the stick to the side. And he made the whole mountain roll around the nose of the airplane. He got back. I don't think he could work for a day. It was just wonderful.
And next we'll hear from Dr. Demetrius Lopez.
Nick Hopkins was probably my... My best story was one that we were all in Jackson Hole, and we're coming out of his place, going to Rendezvous Mountain for a hike. And, you know, coming from Brazil, hiking was not like, at least mountain hiking was not my forte. And good shape, we're going in the mountain. And I had Rafael Rodriguez was with me. I believe maybe a lot was there. We had all the fellows-to-be. Everybody was on this hike. All of a sudden, we're mid-mountain, and we start like get a little bit hungry and start talking about, you know, oh, my God, is there water around here? Is there something to eat? And then he goes, Nick goes like, I have the right thing for you guys. And he goes to his pocket and he hands to this trail mix. And everybody started eating that. And all of a sudden, I think Rafa, one of us ate, it was a piece of cloth on the trail mix. And then we go like, oh, Nick, there's some, what is in this mix? I don't know. I just put it in my pocket every year, and we just hand out. So it was like this trail mix has been there, you know, very much like aged on his pocket. It was an incredible experience, but it helped us, and it got us to the top of the mountain. So it was really a funny story. We thought I don't think he knew what he was giving to us at that point. So, but it was amazing. I don't know how we didn't get more bears and animals following us because of trail mix. But that was kind of a cool story. Nick gave me, I remember, his phone number. Before I got into Buffalo, I met him in a meeting, and he gave me his business card with his number to call him if any problems. And I was very nice, happy and honored and welcome to Buffalo when I got that from him. And so I... literally, the day I was traveling from Chicago to Buffalo, to move to Buffalo, I felt that I needed to let him know that I was arriving in the city, that he hired me to be a resident, you know. And this is a culture shock, I think, you know, something probably most residents in the United States would not do it. But I felt that I should give him a call. This is Sunday night, mind you, you know. So I get in there in the airport, and I look at the bars and the screens, and there is a Knicks game going on, and it was New York Knicks, so it must be Nick must love the Knicks, you know. I in Brazil, we follow our soccer teams like crazy, you know, like your city. So I call him and I say, Nick, this is Demetrius. And oh, Demetrius, everything okay? You know, his word of why I'm calling him Sunday night. And I go like, Nick, I just want to let you know that I arrived in town, and I'm ready to start residency, you know, next week. And, oh, thank you, Demetrius. He's just being very kind and very nice, you know. But I go, I don't know what to say anymore. And so I go like, oh, how about those Knicks? You know, they're looking good. And he looks at me, Demetrius, I have no idea about the Knicks, you know. And it took me a while to understand that that was just not the way how things went. So I thought it was really funny. Fun. You know, some of the things that I learned from Nick are really have to do a lot with how you choose a team and you pick folks to be near you. I think that it was amazing. You know, we had AJ Wakalu, Adnan Qureshi, at that time, Lee Gutterman was still in the program. But subsequently, we had a lot of amazing people that came through the program. You know, and I really admire so much how he was able to, you know, get all, even if you look at our lab with Baru Lieber and Stefan Rudin, we had every specialty, every folks coming from different experiences, you know, coming together. And I think made Buffalo very special at that moment is the ability to have an amazing, you know, team and the choice of the different strengths coming together. The three words I would describe Nick are an innovator, a father, and extreme talent. One of the things that I would love the world to know about Nick Hopkins is that he had the vision, and everything that was built was actually something that it was very dynamic process. You know, that this is not something that I believe he could even at the time that we were, the program was just starting to actually have the idea where it came to Jacobs became. I believe that whole process would be very difficult for you to actually know exactly how things are gonna fall into place. But it's beautiful for me to actually share with everybody that he knew that he needed to go into that direction, you know. And I think the lesson for all of us is that it was just this idea that you have to fight for the things you want, you believe you want to be, even though, you know, is the idea is not concrete yet, it's not completely formed, you know. This is a process, you know. And I think that it worked out in the most amazing way with what turned out to be what we call his vision in Buffalo. But it was not always like that. I think there were a lot of trial and errors, a lot of, doors are closed, but he kept trying until he found a way to get into that final result.
Are there any specific quotes or words of wisdom from Nick Hopkins that have stayed with you?
Demetrius, nothing good happens after midnight. So this happened every time we would go into an event or something. He would say, it's time to go to bed. And tomorrow, 6 a.m., we meet for rounds. And I think that it was very much like this opinion of how much you need your sleep, how much you want to be like, you know, mindful of I think the social interactions and it definitely was very important to me to hear from somebody at his stature that he cared about that too, you know. And I think that maybe we don't talk too much about that, but Nick was extremely preserved a lot his family, his image in a way that it was very, very important to me as an example. I mean, Dr. Hopkins' legacy it's really, I think his fellows, I think the ability to change basically how we all felt about cerebral vascular surgery and medicine in general. I think he really it was incredible how he was able to, each individual that passed, and I can speak for myself, it completely changed my life, you know, in terms of what I perceive to be the impact we had in medicine, and even like how I saw myself as continuing that role that he definitely gave us the tools to be able to be successful, you know, and I think that that is a gift and an impact that just multiplied much more than he could imagine of his legacy, because it still lives on, basically.
Is there one thing or something that comes to mind that you think people that weren't part of his program that don't share that same opportunity to watch him and learn from him that he influenced? Is there, you know, I've seen him train other physicians on how to do carotid stents. I've seen the multidisciplinary approach where he's brought these specialties together. Is there something else you think that he's known for or could be known for now that he's not here with us anymore that will live on?
The impact of Nick on the folks that were not in Buffalo, or maybe they didn't even meet him, or that was that that it, basically he enabled the field to grow that now most of us enjoy, but you may not even know that there was his hand in the back making sure that this hard battles that had to happen to be able to let's say make this what it is today, endovascular, cerebrovascular surgery, the way how these procedures are done today. I feel that we got there faster because of his influence. Now, another impact from Nick, I believe, was the global view of the multiple specialties that could participate on that. And I think that, you know, training the first stroke neurologists, having a huge, let's say, connection with cardiology, certainly for even for neurosurgery at that time, I think that is tremendous because it made the field to be owned by every specialty that had an interest and could contribute with it. And I think that he's really the person that brought all that together and brought the ability for us to grow as a specialty in the strength that we have today. I think that's a huge impact he had also.
Can you share something about, you know, the Buffalo environment and early days for Dr. Hopkins? You know, how was he able to be so successful?
John, and remember, I was first getting to Buffalo in kind of mid 90s, 1995, 96, and we were like literally finding out, you know, I signed up for a neurosurgery training and these things were going all in parallel. We're seeing like a tremendous change on attention, and all of a sudden we're getting calls to Dr. Hopkins are presenting all over the world. And yeah. We obviously had, he had an amazing team to hold the fort locally, but it was incredible how, you know, we see, I feel that a lot of people were sensing that he was growing, but when you go out to have this global presence locally, you could find a lot of resistance from folks that may take advantage of that position to take over or slow down the progress, whatever it is. And I think that that's probably something not discussed so much for Dr. Hawkins, but I think it was an incredible strength of him to be able to manage that and advise us on growing and managing this. So I think we all had to learn so much at an early stage in our careers how to handle the politics of dealing with you have a vision or such an incredible things are happening that the world recognizes, but locally you're being sometimes shut down. And it's amazing for me. It's almost like the high speed boat and the waves that you create in the back, you know, like, and I think Nick had that, you know, he was very much in a mission and going all over the world. But when you come home, there were a lot of waves that we had to deal with. And I think that he was incredible navigating through that. And honestly, for me, it's a great lesson, because we all probably share some of that experience as you, you know, just be very mindful and be able to cover all the different fronts that were being developed at that time. So I just want to let you know that, you know, I appreciate the opportunity. I do think Nick is all the things that were said about how you feel special talking to him. I definitely felt like a son, and I treat him as my dad too. And he's a role model that it's very unique, John. And I think we're very fortunate to have had him, you know, in our lives. And it's hard to speak without getting emotional about it, because that's the kind of impact he has. So.
Hi, this is John Murray at the WFITN meeting in New York City. I'm standing here with Dr. Adnan Siddiqui from Buffalo, New York. I wanted to get some perspective from you on the unfortunate passing of Nick Hopkins.
Nick was an incredible human being. He was my mentor. He was a friend. He was a guide. He was a resource. And he really made me who I am today. So it's really tough for me personally. I think he had an incredible impact on the entire community of endovascular neurosurgery. I think he was a pioneer and a rebel rouser and instigator of change. And I loved every minute that I got a chance to spend with him.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Adnan.
We'll take a quick break from our episode to bring back our sponsor, Darren Amick, Strategic Account Manager for Zeus.
You know, Darren, it feels like innovation is happening even more rapidly than ever before. So with that in mind, what trends are you seeing based off of your customers' needs?
So catheters are getting more complex and they're going smaller. So with that, there's an increased need for material science expertise as well as process development. Zeus is uniquely positioned because we've got the best polymer innovations in the world and have for close to 60 years. And with CathX, we now have process development expertise. So this has positioned us to be able to not only work with these materials that we have, but also develop next-gen materials for our customers with catheters in mind and with a focus on where the industry is going, and have direct voice of customer with our customers. An example of this that we've come up with is the Streamliner NG. So this is our most flexible liner yet. It's got a proprietary film cast process that we came up with in-house, and it's improved consistency, reduced imperfections, and reduced pinholes that some of our competitors have dealt with, which is obviously going to impact customer yield. We're targeting this towards the neurovascular market, but we've had some really interesting testing in-house, and we're really eager to get this out to our customers to try in some of the other therapy areas as well.
Well, congratulations, Darren, on your new product launch, Streamliner NG. So where can our audience go to learn more about Streamliner NG?
You can go to our website, www.zeusinc.com, or reach out to your commercial contact. We've got a lot of people out there that are really excited to get this product in your hands.
I can definitely see why. So with that in mind, how do your customers typically engage with Zeus?
Ideally, early and often, and ideally, it's us engaging with our customers as well. We put a huge focus on education. So we do tech summits with our customers, and we really want to engage with the R&D teams and hear what their problems are, work together, and work as partners to solve complex challenges. And we also have a global team of field application engineers. I don't think anyone else in the industry can offer the level of expertise that we've got locally for all of our customers for global support. We've got people all over the country that are ready to come in and help you solve any of your challenges, as well as look for any of the challenges that you're having with assembling some of the current products that you could be working on right now. Lastly, I wanted to mention our NPD Accelerator program. This is something new that we've brought online, and obviously getting to market quickly with high quality products is the goal here. And this is something that we've brought out that's gonna help you facilitate that. So please reach out to your Zeus contact to ask about that. We'd love to partner with you on that as well.
Darren Amick, Strategic Account Manager for Zeus. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you.
And for those who want to learn more about how Zeus can engage with medical device companies and help you bring your products to market faster, please visit www.zeusinc.com. And now we're back to our memorial episode honoring Dr. Nick Hopkins.
Let's move a little to just the professional impact you've had too. And I'm aware that you recently received the prestigious Cardiology Research Foundation Pulse Setter Champion Award. And I think that this was a surprise to you and the impact that you've had. Can you tell us a little bit about this honor and what it means to you in the context of your career?
Sure. I've spent a good part of my career, given the fact that I learned from a cardiologist in the beginning, and it was clear to me early on that cardiology had been treating acute MIs for some time before neuro was born. And it was pretty clear to me that they had incredibly good catheter skills and much better technology than we had. So so it was a natural to be learning from cardiology. So I began to kind of espouse that to others. And then, you know, the more I got into it, the more I realized that all the disciplines have something to offer, and they're all different. I mean, all the interventional disciplines. We all have our organ system. You know, we do the head and the spine. Cardiologists do the heart, and now more and more periphery. And then you got radiologists and vascular surgeons doing peripheral. Vascular surgeons are learning interventional. Everybody has their own little, you know, tricks. And that's why bringing all the disciplines together is so incredibly important. And that's what we've tried to do at some of our conferences. And I think, you know, that's collaboration is key. I went to every TCT meeting in cardiology for God knows how, maybe 25 years. I learned so much. And I always, when I was giving talks, I was always espousing the need for interdisciplinary interaction, because I think, you know, we had something to offer cardiology as well. But, you know, I was just a bump on a log at the cardiology meetings. And the cardiology is an amazing specialty. And it never occurred to me that they were listening to me about the need to come together. I didn't care. I was learning from them. And that's what counted to me. So when I got a call from Marty Leon's group, I was like, what, are you kidding me? Why would you give your greatest honor to a neurosurgeon? And I still don't really know. But I was at the dinner in New York City honoring the Pulse Setter. There were 400 people in the audience. I didn't know 10% of them, but it was a great honor and a great opportunity to further espouse the need for collaboration, which was what it was all about.
Now, there's a lot to be proud of in your career. I mean, we can probably talk for hours and hours about the stories and the things that you've done. And but I'd ask you to look back on your career. Does anything stand out in particular that you're especially proud of?
Well, we didn't talk much about entrepreneurship. TCT, 1997, I'm asked to give a talk at one of their FDA sessions on the need to protect the brain during carotid stenting. And I did my first carotid stent in like 19 way before anybody else was doing it. And I don't even remember the date, but it was scared the daylights out of me, because I knew if I cracked a plaque, the only time I did is when I couldn't I couldn't, for one reason or another, do an endarterectomy because I did that from, you know, the beginning of my career. So can't do an endart for one reason or another. And so doing a carotid stent made sense. And every time you crack a carotid plaque, you release debris. And where is it going to go? It's going to go to the brain, which scared the daylights out of me. But that's, so I gave a plea at this TCT meeting for, it's called an FDA fireside chat. Gave a plea for industry to develop something to help protect the brain when we do carotid stenting. I came down off the podium and I was introduced to a guy by the name of Fred Khosravi, who has turned out to be another amazing mentor for me, not just in entrepreneurship, but in just his, he's just got a moral compass that just stands out above anybody I've ever seen. And he was just getting into the world of real entrepreneurship, and he had never started a company. And he said, I have an idea that a friend of mine gave me. Amr Salahaya gave him an idea for a little, it was a little filter. And, but that little filter turned out to be the EPI filter wire. And Fred asked me to start a company with him. And I was just the clinical voice. And it's another thing I learned along the way about entrepreneurship. As a clinician, don't try to be the business person. Most physicians can't resist trying to be the business person, and that's the worst thing you can do. Be a clinician and help the business people. But I learned a lot from, you know, all the venture capital people and PE people that were on those boards. And mostly I learned to keep my mouth shut when it came to business stuff. And I'm, you know, proud that I could make some clinical contributions to some of these companies.
Yeah, that was a great contribution. I'm going to shift gears a little bit, talk about you as a person. I talked to Margie. Obviously, I've talked to lots of people about you. And there's one very common theme that emerges about you, which is the high level of humanity that you bring to every aspect of your life, from your family to supporting your fellows, your colleagues, and then your community. You know, you're often known as the mayor of Buffalo, but you haven't run for office, from what I understand. And, but really, it's this humanity that stands out. Your rabid focus on your patients and doing the right thing, and it's definitely a theme of what you've already said today. But what is your moral and ethical compass for how you approach your work and life?
I'd say it starts with mom and dad. And my dad was in the mechanical contractor. That's a tough business. Mm-hmm. And, you know, more often than not, it ends up in a lawsuit. Everybody loved my father. And when it came to doing the right thing, there wasn't any question. That's what he did. And my mother the same. And, you know, he would walk into his office and they had, I don't know, hundreds of employees. Everyone knew him. And he knew them. And he knew their families. He knew what they liked and didn't like. And it was a real inspiration to me. So mom and dad were really a huge impact on me. I think they taught me to do what's right and don't worry about the opposition. If you know you're right, and then if you make a mistake, learn from it. To me, that's, I don't know if that's what you call a moral compass, but that's kind of the way I look at it.
Now, over time, and even today, you've talked about the importance of collaboration if certainly between clinicians, but between clinicians and industry. You talked about how you even at a major meeting stood up and asked for industry's assistance in developing technology. I'm curious to see about how you see the role that industry has played in your work in innovations and how you think this dynamic relationship should work together. Now, let me just qualify. Multiple occasions, you and I have had discussions around how critical that relationship is, so much so that you invite in the past industry to some of your meetings where you talk about the difficult situation so that industry can learn. But you know, in your own words, you know, how important is this relationship?
Well, it's critical. It's critical because how are we ever going to advance the field without industry? You know, you talk about entrepreneurship. There are a lot of clinicians that have a great idea, and then I don't want to tell anybody about it, and I'm going to turn it into a company. Well, I got news for you. It's an awful long way between a good idea and a commercial product. And the only way that can ever happen is with industry. So the collaboration with industry to get an idea to some place where it can be useful is critically important. So that's one really important part. Is the other thing about it is, you know, people that many people, most people, and they're smart dudes, and we as clinicians can learn a lot from them. And I'll never forget one of the best reps we ever had. He was a J&J rep who would come into the cath lab way back, and you'd be, hey, can you get something we can do to solve this problem? Maybe I'll run out and see what I got in my trunk. Or even more important, you know, we have a product for that, but I'll tell you something. Boston Scientific has a better product for this particular problem. You should look at what they have. He wasn't afraid to share that other industry players are, you know, just as creative and innovative. And so he made the biggest impression on me of anybody I've ever met in industry. And it's just so important, the collaboration between industry and physicians. We know so little as clinicians, and industry knows so much. And, you know, you put them together, it's really positive. How about this? If you're a really good clinician, you can save maybe one life at a time if you don't screw it up. If you can invent a device like the EPI filter wire that protects thousands of brains, holy smokes. You know, it's incredible. Just incredible. And so industry has a huge role to play.
Shifting again, when you talked about those very early days, fast forward to today, right? We're a new space, for lack of a better term. It's a new frontier. In your mind, what's the burning questions that you still have that we need to dive into and problem solve?
I think probably the most important disease we face is stroke. You can talk about anything, you know, cancer and so on and so forth, but stroke is something that really should be curable. And I had a huge epiphany many years ago. A patient came in, and you may have seen this. I may have told you before. A priest from Canisius College, and he had a massive stroke, left hemisphere, aphasic, plegic, non-compos mentis, and he languished at one of the local hospitals for, you know, an hour or two before somebody said, why don't you send him over to Hopkins, this lunatic neurosurgeon? So it just by serendipity, I had a a five French diagnostic catheter that I used, you know, to go see what's up. And the damn thing, his anatomy was so smooth that the catheter went very, very smoothly all the way up into the horizontal cavernous carotid, at which point I, you know, you always want to suck back to make sure you're not going to inject something untoward. And I sucked back, and it was kind of a little difficult pulling back, and then a big clot came back. Okay, and sucked back a little more, and then injected some dye. And the T occlusion, which he had in his left carotid bifurcation, was wide open. And that was an epiphany. And I said, we need to do this technically. And I've watched the technology evolve. I was, you know, one of the first ones to use a stent retriever, and it works. But you know what? Talk about serendipity. Somebody put a stent in somebody's head and pulled back and a clot came out. That's real serendipity. And stent retrievers work. But I just had this feeling that aspiration was the way to go. Aspiration is a really neat, it doesn't work all the time, but when it works, it's pretty dramatic. So it's just another tool that we have. But think about the future. The future is there are 16 million strokes in the world every year, and we have maybe, I don't know, how many neurointerventionalists, you'll know better than I, how many neurointerventionalists worldwide? I bet it's a small number.
Yeah, a couple thousand.
Yeah. So how the hell are we going to treat 16 million strokes with 2,000 or 3,000 neurointerventionalists? And that's one of the things I keep preaching. It gets me in trouble. Sometimes I talk about it at a neuro meeting, and nobody'll talk to me. I walk down the halls and people ignore me. And it's because I'm an advocate for doing something that's completely different. Mm-hmm. And it's let's get other specialties into the game.
Yeah, you're rewriting the book.
Well, I don't know, but right now I'm still, to me, one of the biggest challenges is to get the whole neuro world to accept the fact that there are others can do this just as well as they can. And no, they're not going to know all the neuro details, but you know, if we all know that time is the critical factor in stroke intervention. And if somebody out in Timbuktu can stick a catheter in somebody's, head and suck a clot out, within, you know, an hour of the onset, it's going to change the world. And I think, you know, robotics is going to become a very important part of that. We're never going to have enough neurointerventionalists, but if you have a really good robot and you can basically put a robot in the hands of anybody who can use a catheter in Timbuktu, and then you can coach them, and you make a robot so user-friendly that anybody can do it, that's how we're going to maybe approach significant numbers of treatment of acute ischemic stroke. And I think that'll change the world, because, you know, nobody realizes how incredibly important stroke is to the patient, to the family, to society. And, you know, we see stroke patients. It is a disaster. And even a moderate stroke is a disaster. And so, you know, that's the other area that's really important, is we got to focus more on how to take better care of our stroke patients postoperatively, and find other ways to reduce readmissions to the hospital, which is bad for the patient, bad for the, you know, the hospital, bad for society, because it's very expensive. So it's, you know, it's spreading the technology, spreading the skill set, and taking care of the patients postoperatively. And right now, you know, there's not any real focus on managing post-op stroke patients. You treat the stroke, You get them out of the hospital, and then we as clinicians lose contact. So, and then the patients get readmitted for all kinds of, you know, urinary tract infections and pulmonary infections. As boring as that may sound to a neuroclinician, it's really, really important. So that's the other area where I think we can really make an impact in the future.
So last main question, and then I have a few rapid fires for you. The obvious, hard work, focus on patients. I think that's a given. That was what we expect from the new physicians coming into the space. But do you have any advice for those new physicians as they enter the neuro field today?
Work your butt off and have fun.
If you could invite three historical or public figures, dead or alive, to a dinner party, who would they be?
Winston Churchill, George Patton, and Fred Khosravi. But
all right.
He's not a historical figure, but he's such an amazing person.
Great. This is your choice, so you can put whoever you want at that table. It's your dinner. I'll be serving. If you had only one book to read for the rest of your life, what would it be?
That's a tough question. There's so many wonderful books, but not being a terribly religious person, I think I'd still have to say the Bible.
Are you more creative in the morning or the afternoon?
Bonnie says I'm much more creative in the morning. I'm a morning person.
And what is one talent that you wish you had that you do not?
I wish that, I love music. I wish I was an expert pianist.
Very good. And your favorite food?
I think probably veggies.
All right. Jim Kelly or Josh Allen?
Oh, no question. Josh Allen.
And if you hadn't gone into medicine, what would you be doing today?
I would have, matter of fact, my name was on the door of my father's company. I would have gone in I worked as a steam fitter when I was in college. And I would have continued that into mechanical contracting with my family.
Well, I'm going to take this moment.
I'll tell you super quick story.
Oh, please.
My dad, who thought of himself as a glorified plumber because they worked with pipes all the time. So one night they were over for dinner and I had a patient that came in with an obstructed shunt. And so had to go to the OR and open up the shunt. And so I took him with me. And at the end of the procedure, he very quietly sat through the whole thing. And then he looked at me, he said, "All those years of education and all that money, and you're still just a damn plumber." Early on in my career, I learned that, you don't know everything and the people around you don't know everything. The only way you learn is to travel and interact with other people in other areas, other disciplines, et cetera. And I learned about glue or NBCA, another J&J product, if I remember correctly. That experience, I knew it worked for AV malformations. And so when I couldn't get it in the US because it wasn't approved, I hooked up with an interventionalist in Toronto, Carl. Carl Tabru. And so that I would go up and they would give me some glue and I would bring it back and sneak it over the border. And I probably would be in jail if they had caught me and figured out what I was doing. But that's how I got glue into the US. And back then, people weren't questioning what I was doing so much. Today, they'd probably string me up if I did something like that.
Thanks for sharing.
My pleasure.
Well, we hope you enjoyed that conversation with Dr. Hopkins. As I mentioned earlier, we've got a few more interviews that John Murray did with colleagues, peers, and mentees of Dr. Hopkins. First, we'll hear from Dr. Jay Mocco.
Three words that I would use to describe Nick are passionate, inspiring, and innovative. And what I mean by that is Nick exuded an incredible passion for what he did every day. He deeply believed in the things he believed. It was a sort of he just held the truths of the value of what he did, of the wonder of his life and where he was, and that kind of passionate energy was very inspiring. Which brings you to the second. There wasn't a single person that was around Nick that didn't feed off that passion, that energy, and then feel inspired themselves to want to be similar, make a difference, believe that they could change things. And then, sort of, what's kind of extra amazing on top of all of that was his sense of innovation, his desire, and his ability to look at things with a fresh eye every time. And his belief that things could be done different. You can be passionate and inspiring, but not necessarily be innovating and changing. There's different directions one can go with their energies. Nick always inspired those around him to look at things differently, to do things differently, and to try to improve care for patients. And so while they're all interrelated, I think they were all three unique things that truly define Nick: his passion, the way he inspired those around him, and his constant commitment and fundamental worldview that was centered on innovation. Something that always sticks with me that Nick would say a lot was he it actually wasn't words, although he'd follow them up, but he'd kind of hold up two fingers. And what he meant was, what he used to be told from his dad, that you have two ears and one mouth, and therefore you should listen twice as much as you talk. And that's regular good advice that people get. But think about it, for someone who was so innovative, someone who was in such a level of influence and power and inspiration, he still fundamentally felt that was one of the real truisms, that you should listen twice as much as you talk. That really stuck with me. I like to talk, so that means I have to do a lot of listening to make sure I keep that ratio up. And I think that I owe a lot to Nick for teaching me that approach to life. What I've learned from him, what our relationship has taught me, is that there's no substitute for the fundamentals, for being a thoughtful, good person. I mean, it's such a tremendous testimony, I think, to the world that Nick was able to do the things he did, be successful the way he was, and yet fundamentally, he was an incredibly thoughtful and good person. He's incredibly dedicated to his family. He's raised a wonderful family with a plethora of grandkids and all whom are close and spend time together. He had wonderful relationships with his wife, his children, his grandchildren. My wife and I got to know Bonnie and Nick very well over the years, and we routinely say how we want to be like them, how they're a model for us to be so in love, so active, so connected for so long into their lives. It's just heartwarming to know that a human being like that, a person who is loyal to his trainees, a person who is fundamentally committed to good, still can have incredible professional success, still can be a person who changes the world for the better. And that's really what Nick is. I mean, what Nick did for Western New York, for Buffalo, his commitment to that, to his hometown, building the JI, so much. And it all was rooted in good, not in ambition or power play or, taking advantage of others. It was always doing for others. And so for me, that's at the heart of what I take away from Nick. I use him as my own personal inspiration for what life can be like and I think should be like. Dr. Hopkins' impact, his legacy for the field of neurointervention, It's close to unfathomable. It's so broad, so deep. I think I would boil it down into maybe three buckets. One is his impact through his trainees. He embraced neurointervention when the neurosurgical community did not, and he embraced and helped so many young neurosurgeons learn about neurointervention. And I think the field of neurointervention is richer for that. When you look at his diaspora of trainees, they're continuing to completely change the world. And so I think that that's a huge pillar to his contribution. And then I think second, you look at his innovation, the technologies he's helped bring to the fore, his focus on innovation and improving the field by improving technologies, the fact that Buffalo has become the place where new technologies go to learn, to be learned about, to evolve, and to get feedback. While I was there, we were always on the cutting edge. We were always in the most forward thinking and newest trials. And I think that is a testament to who he is and what his contribution has been. And lastly, I'd say his contribution, it should not be underestimated. It's a contribution of building the Jacobs Institute and this massive entity in West New York and in Buffalo. I mean, Buffalo is a great town, but it's pretty incredible that the world comes to Buffalo for neurointervention. And that's an incredible legacy for him. And I think perhaps one of the ones he's most proud of. He loved that town, and he has made it the ground zero of education and innovation in the neurointerventional space. I would say those are his legacies.
Dr. Mocco, can you share a brief personal or professional story about Nick Hopkins?
Certainly, there's so many to choose from, but I think one that's really hits at the center is when I was a fellow and training with Nick, I was researching a new way to analyze aneurysms, and I was trying to engage with and partner with the International Study of Unruptured Intracranial Aneurysms to look at their data. And as sometimes happens, they hadn't answered a number of emails, and I figured time to move on. Nick happened to pop by the angio suite that morning and just say, "Hey, how are things going? What's going on? How's that aneurysm research stuff you're doing?" And I said, "I tried, but I wasn't able to connect with them. But there's all these other great things going on, and I spent a few minutes talking about the other stuff." And he said, "Okay," and he left, and that was it. I spent the whole day doing cases, and when I got back to the little fellow office at the time, and I pulled up my email, I found he had emailed the chair of neurosurgery at the Mayo Clinic where the trial was run and had said, "Why are you stonewalling all of my guys? How come you haven't engaged with him? What's going on? We're such good collaborators," and really gone after him.
Yeah.
And I mean, at first I was petrified my career was going to be destroyed. And then I saw a whole series of emails, all that happened without me knowing while I was still doing cases, that essentially where Nick engaged with them, resolved all issues. And the next thing I knew, I was heading out to the Mayo Clinic to review films and be a member of the Ishwa writing group. Wow. I mean, he
Yeah.
went to bat for his 1 year out fellow, the guy who was still training with him, and he didn't even pause, and he didn't make a big deal of it, and he just did what he thought was right. And I thought that was pretty spectacular. Something I'd like the world to know about Dr. Nick Hopkins is just what an incredibly, fundamentally good human being he was. He was so innovative. He did so many things. And his approach to life was a little iconoclastic. And as a result, lots of people wondered. Maybe lots of people didn't think he was the greatest person because he was doing things differently. And people don't like to see things done differently. But man, just good through and through, honest, forthright, supportive of his family, friends, and trainees. His legacy should be one that highlights Nick Hopkins, the man. I think that's why he was successful, despite the fact that he was doing things no one else was willing or able or could imagine doing. He was a really fantastic human being.
And I'm here with Dr. Ricardo Hanel from Jacksonville, Florida. We had some pretty bad news this last weekend where the icon, Nick Hopkins, passed away. I just want to ask you, Ricardo, tell me a little bit about your relationship with Nick and what it means to you.
Nick, for me, my American father, spent 6 years in Buffalo, came to Buffalo in 2001, didn't know how to puncture a femoral artery. Everything that I learned on endovascular and a lot of what I learned in surgery came from Nick. Role model as a father, as a grandfather, innovator, researcher, physician, whole package. I think, quoting a friend, Adam Arthur, I think Nick is the Harvey Cushing of our time. He changed the landscape of cerebrovascular surgery. He brought endovascular to neurosurgery, and the rest is history. I think it's going to be very hard to replace Bonnie, the kids, the Buffalo family. It takes two men to substitute him with Elad Levin and Adnan Siddiqui to do the job that Nick did alone for many years. It's a big loss, but rest in peace. It was a tough last year for him. We'll miss him dearly. I cried a couple of times already thinking about him and writing to Bonnie and writing to our Buffalo family and to the world. That's impossible to replace him, but his legacy is alive. All the people that he trained and he inspired over his years is just phenomenal to me to be part of that, to be a little piece of his legacy. And I hope through the people that I train, that I inspire, he will be alive and his legacy will move on.
Yeah, I know he had a special relationship with you as well. He often referred to you. So we share the condolences to Bonnie and the family. I will tell you, though, we did capture Dr. Hopkins in a podcast that will be broadcast in the next few months. So we'll get to hear all the things that Dr. Hanel here mentioned, his mentorship, innovation, where he came from, how he got here. So I think we're looking forward to hearing that, and hopefully we can share that with generations to come. So thanks for sharing your heartfelt words. It's meaningful. No, he won't be replaced. Yes, he was a pioneer, a maverick, but we'll always know who he was, and through who you've trained and others, I think that will live forever. So, well said.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.
John's next interview is with Dr. Adnan Karishe.
So, Dr. Hopkins was my mentor and my teacher, and I joined university at Buffalo in 1998, and I was there, finished my fellowship in 2000, and actually stayed as faculty for 2000 up to 2002. And he was very instrumental in changing the way I approach things. So, you know, he was more than a teacher, he was a true mentor to me. And, you know, the influence of what he taught me carries with me 20 years later. So, you know, I cannot say specific story because every day was a memorable day with him. I think that, you know, if you did a procedure with him, you were so mesmerized with how much he had thought through in such a short period of time and how calm he was in the procedures. And that actually kind of motivated me to change my approach to really start to think, look at things objectively. And really, when I do procedures, I'm actually almost always thinking that I'm in the shadows.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that thing that he taught me was innovation. I think that, you know, he could see things that no one else could see. I mean, we would be looking at the same set of information and he could see a future that other people were just unable to see. And, you know, he was a very humble, quiet guy, but I don't know what he had. He would motivate people in a way that nobody else can. But it was just amazing. For somebody who you didn't really see, you know, like the whole energetic and, you know, somehow he had that feeling that, you know, that persona. that he could actually motivate you and make you believe in yourself. I mean, I think that, you know, everybody that was there before me, after me, carried that spirit. It really was something that just carried on and lived in you. Beautiful. So I think that, you know, I'm very proud to be Dr. Hopkins Fellow. I'm very proud as being the first neurologist that he ever trained. And I remember the first time I was in the angiographic suite, he came and he said, did you see, get a sense of how to wear the surgical gloves now? And I said, yes, I think I got it now.
Oh, that's funny.
But he was very kind, and, you know, obviously I did not have the surgical background that some of my co-fellows and previous fellows had. But I think he was very accommodating, and he realized this, the strengths, and he encouraged me to pursue those strengths. Number one, visionary. Number two, mentor. And number three, you know, giving a sense of believing in yourself. I mean, I think that very few people can do that. I mean, I think that everybody around, you know, in that particular group of people, I think that he gave them the opportunity to pursue what they had, the, could pursue. And he gave them the encouragement to do more than what they were doing. So really, he believed that they had more to give. And he encouraged them to kind of, you know, provide or give to the fullest of their potential.
If you had to select something out of all of those fantastic attributes, what would you say the world should know about him?
I think that he was a visionary, but visionary in a little bit broader term than what we think it is. He saw the field and what it could be, but he also saw people and what they can become. So I think that the definition of visionary for him is a little broader than the classic definition that we use for other individuals.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything that you want to just say or add outside of those questions that we had?
I think I would just want to highlight that all the people that he trained, we belong to a family. And, you know, that sense of belonging and family can only happen because of the mentor. Because if that spirit is not passed down, then you just don't have that feeling. So we really all feel like we are part of a family. So many people ask that, did you start interventional neurology? And I have to correct them to say, no, Dr. Hopkins started interventional neurology.
And our final interview of this episode is with Dr. Rafael Rodriguez.
What I have to mention about Nick and my first experience with him was when I started my fellowship. But before that was during my interview as a fellow. I never will forget when after I was interviewed by the other attendees, he called me to his office. I sit there in front of him, and he showed me a pile of CVs from different people. Actually, it was 17 CVs from people that was applying to the fellowship. And he said, you know, he said to me, you know, Rafi, these 70 people have been applying for my fellowship, but you have something special that they don't have the other 17s, is that you are going to change the way of that health is provided in your country, in Puerto Rico. And you're going to an academic program, and you will continue my legacy of training other people. Change the way that the medicine is delivered in Puerto Rico. That is the only reason why I have to choose you as a fellow. And that really touched me, you know, that created to me a feeling of commitment, a feeling representing not only myself, I was representing Puerto Rico too. And I'm going to be a reflection of him there, you know. So I have it was a big challenge. You know, I was a guy that come from a tropical island to a place that was cold and hell. And besides he treated me like a son, you know. And I always feel protected not only by him, also by AJ too, you know, because I have to be fair that between AJ and Nick train me. And those are my two professors, you know. You know that. It was there when I was doing my fellowship. And one of the things that I remember two phrases from him. One was, it's better to be lucky than good. So that teach you to be humble. Don't never think that you are better than anybody. That sometimes things happen because you are lucky and sometimes not. And the other thing was when a case was very complicated and we cannot fix it, they say, let's stop here. Because if we stop here, this patient is going to have a tomorrow. If we continue, maybe we'll kill the patient here. That was the two things that I always remember. In terms of three words that I can describe Nick was first, commitment, visionary. He was a visionary. He always and the other thing is persistence. Never give up. I think that those three words describe pretty well Nick. Also, another thing, I remember one day that we was traveling to Erie County. That we was he was driving there because he's going to teach a cardiology how to do a carotid angioplasty and stenting. So he told me to go with him. So we have a long drive there, and we talk everything about me, about my future. And I say, and he told me, listen, Rafi, I very regret that you have to go back. I wish that you stay here with me, but I know that you have a commitment with Dr. Rifkinson, that was the chairman of neurosurgery by that time here in Puerto Rico, and with your people. And I cannot prevent you or make something that you stay here with me, knowing that you're going to help your people. And I think that he was like telling me, you know, don't go, but you know, I have to go time, you know, I have to do it, and you are witness of what happened. His legacy was so important that I already have been trained 19 fellows from different countries of Latin America and from Puerto Rico that have been established new programs in their countries. And I always told Nick, you have grandchildren in Latin America, because I have been training all of these people, and everything happened because you gave me the opportunity to be trained by you. The three words that I will use to describe Nick was persistent, because he never give up. He always have a solution for different endovascular conditions. Visionary, because he made the path so the things get easier to do during a case. And other thing was beside the persistent and be a visionary, was he also was compassion too. It was compassion. Okay.
Perfect.
Not only with the patient, but also with the fellows.
Great. And then you answered a few of these other questions. You talked about the quote. Is there anything that you'd want to say that you think the world should know that we don't know about Nick Hopkins?
Well, you know, I think that the world knows already that he was a pioneer in endovascular neurosurgery, one of the fewest one. I think that he shared his knowledge with all of his fellows. And he always was there for us. I think that I was involved in different situations during my professional life, that sometimes I grab the phone and call Nick, what you think about this? What I should do about this? And he always say to me that never give up, that always think in helping the other people, that never mess up or waste time with people that try to create problems to you, that you follow looking forward and always be on the high road. Yeah. That was always one of his favorites one. And it was only always... There is one more that I have to mention, because he said you can walk on a dark forest with a big stick under your shoulders. You can pass that forest, and if you don't have to use the big stick, do you only use it? But if you have to use it, try to hit pretty well that the other one cannot stand up again. You know, what's he referring about people that try to mess up with you, that they have envy about your progress, all of that stuff. Because let me tell you, beside all of what Nick did, he have a lot of opponents at the early beginning. A lot of people that really feel envy about him, that they don't want his success. And he overcome all of that. I think that you was part of that, because you always was there in the angel suite. And you know, yeah, all of the struggle and problems that happened years. And
you know, I think about it today, and I was pondering it. You know, he was a professional friend for me, you know, and like you. And you don't realize what you're missing until you don't have it. And I think I think that this podcast will surface the humanity that he possessed, which I don't think many of those people that you're referencing in the early days took any time to learn about him. And he was a pariah. They were trying to run him out of town. They thought he was dangerous. They were saying he was a cowboy. But he pushed the field to a whole new category. And we would look, you just said there's multiple countries in Latin America, what, over 20 fellows. I met with Adnan Qureshi. He's got over 40 fellows. Think about the extension, look, globally and specialty wise, that he had an influence in, and patients today are treated because of it. And I think sometimes jealousy and envy and maybe conservatism steps in the way. So I'm hopeful that the podcast and comments like you just made, people start to realize that there was a lot of good in, and the only way that we get where we are today is when you push the envelope, and Nick was pushing the envelope.
Yeah, I have to mention another experience that I have with him. When I come to Puerto Rico, the first 150 patients, I not receive any reimbursement, because the medical insurance never understand why a neurosurgeon was doing radiology work. And he said, you are not a radiologist, you are a neurosurgeon. So they wanted that I do the medical insurance, and some people in radiology department want that I perform the embolization, and the radiologist made the reading for the procedure, you know. So the medical insurance told me, well, if you bring me a letter that you was trained by the radiology professor, then we are going to start to pay you. So I talked to Nick and said, well, Rafi, I am professor of radiology here too, so I'm going to write the letter. So he wrote the letter, and as soon as the medical insurance have that letter, I start to receive the reimbursement from my embolizations. So what was That's a great. Tough beginning. I think that I was number six fellow of NIC, and was the early beginning of the specialty. So they smash everybody, even the peer, neurosurgery peers, look at you like a strange bug, and something that they always told me, that you study endovascular and that is going to disappear in a couple of years. You're losing your talent, your surgical talent. And you know, today I can say that thanks to pioneers as Nick Hopkins, that never happened. Instead, great. Now they have to be trained on endovascular in order to finish their residency program. We have a board, and you know, he was the one, the driving force to promote endovascular neurosurgery among the United, around the United States. And his belief and teaching are worldwide and known by everybody, you know.
Right.
And
right.
I wish that I know that he's near God there in the paradise right now, because he did a lot of good to people. He did a lot of good, not only for people, but for patients too.
Well, that is a wrap. Thanks so much for joining us on this episode of the Neuro Innovation Talks podcast. Thanks, of course, to our friends at Johnson & Johnson MedTech Neurovascular. It's been great to work with them, in particular with John Murray, who's spearheaded this effort and really helped us tell some important neurovascular stories. If you don't want to miss a future episode of Neuro Innovation Talks or our other great Device Talks podcast, make sure you subscribe to the Device Talks Podcast Network. We'll have future podcast episodes sent directly to you. You can also follow us on YouTube. We'll have our audio and video portions or versions up there. So lots of great ways to keep informed and to gain great medtech insights. Finally, make sure you share this podcast episode on LinkedIn and other social media channels. And when you do, connect with me, Tom Salemi, Editorial Director at Device Talks, and our great managing editor, Haleen Brown. We'd love to be part of your future MedTech conversations. That's it, folks. Thanks again for joining us on this episode of the Neuro Innovation Talks podcast.